by the time I'm seeing a child who's 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, who's wheezy and coughing and having infections, sometimes they will have an underlying diagnosis, an immunodeficiency, cystic fibrosis, you know, something that they've been born with that is causing the problem. But that's a minute number of children compared to what we're actually seeing. The rest of it is just living circumstances. Now, when we see those children, by the time they're having problems, the damage is being done.
Hello and welcome to the Not Many Adults podcast, pioneers for children's health and well-being. My name is David Cole and together with my wife Hannah, we are the founders of UK children's charity Thinking of Oscar. The mission of the charity is to bring the future of healthcare to children, and during this podcast we talk to individuals and organisations that are doing just that. In this episode we are going to be discussing the incredibly important topic of health inequalities in children. Addressing this issue is a priority for all children's hospitals across the UK and many around the world. One in three children in the UK lives in relative poverty, and research shows a clear and consistent link between child poverty and paediatric morbidity and mortality. There is no better person to discuss this topic with than Dr. Ian Sinner, who is a consultant respiratory paediatrician at Alderhay Children's Hospital, as well as a professor within the Division of Children's Health at the University of Liverpool. Ian's research focuses on paediatric asthma and neonatal lung disease, and he is particularly interested in the impact of social and health inequalities on children. Without further ado, I will let Ian explain more about the issue as we discuss what measures he and his team are taking to try and help. Ian, hello. Thank you so much for joining us on the Not Many Adults podcast.
Thanks very much for the invitation. It's nice to speak to you.
Well, you know, we're absolutely delighted to have you on, and such an important topic of conversation, I think. But equally, we're recording this quite late in the day for both of us. You've been in hospital all day, and we've been at work. So, you know, from that perspective, and joining us, we really do appreciate it. But the topic of today's conversation is inequalities, and I think as we were discussing before we kind of pressed record, we're seeing a lot of conversations around inequalities around many, many different areas of society these days. But actually one area that I guess those of us that are working in that kind of paediatric arena will think about, but it's not necessarily a general conversation. And that's why it's so exciting to talk to you. So thinking about inequalities with child health. But maybe we can just start by learning a little bit more about you and how you got to be doing what you're doing and where you're doing it and what have you.
Right, so I'm I've got a lovely job, I've got a lovely life. I'm a consultant respiratory paediatrician in Alderhay Children's Hospital in Liverpool, which is a big specialist children's hospital. I've got amazing colleagues, you know, I work amongst some of the best people in the world in their field. And the reason I got into inequalities, not so much got into, so I've always been into the idea of inequalities, and I'll come on to that as why, but in terms of why I've become more vocal about inequalities and social determinants of health in the last few years is that despite working in this amazing place with amazing colleagues in, you know, medicine, surgery, intensive care, the thing that really holds us back is the social determinants of health. We can do everything we can to help children, but the damage is often done by the time they're coming to us, and the injustice of that is tangible. You know, it's so upsetting to see that there are things holding children back, and you know, like you guys, you know, my life is focused around making things better for children, and when you meet like-minded people such as yourself, the conversation inevitably turns to the idea that that some children just have a raw deal and it's unfair. And I mean, in terms of how I got into it, I think it's probably something that I've seen since I was growing up. And certainly in the 80s and 90s, the kinds of things that I remember were around inequalities and around injustice. But also I remember being quite inspired by things that were happening when I was a child. You know, I remember being quite inspired by what I saw about Nelson Mandela, and you know, in particular, what I remember taking away as a 6 or 7 year old was that, or the thing that's really stuck with me through my life, a really formative thing, was not so much the black people fighting for Nelson Mandela's freedom, but the white people that said, this is unfair, this is unjust. And, you know, it's something that I think my parents have instilled in me since I was little. You know, my dad, when I went to medical school, said, you're going to be a doctor. Lots of people are going to tell you that you're very clever and very special. And they're nodding and he went, you're not. you're no more clever or special than anyone else. Go to medical school and learn how lucky you've been. So when I was in medical school in Newcastle, it just opened my eyes to how, you know, how really good people are being forced to live in quite difficult circumstances. And it's something that's stuck with me since. And I think I really found my voice when I became a consultant. And I think I do everyone's head in, because this is all I talk about all day, every day. But I agree with you. I think it's really important.
There must be an interesting dichotomy, because as you said, you work in a fantastic hospital. We've had our mutual friend who actually introduced us, Ian Hennessy, on here, and you know, we've done a lot of work, and I've been to the hospital many, many times, which I'm, you know, fortunate enough. So it's a wonderful facility. But actually, given where it is, for those listening, not necessarily in the UK, and understand kind of where Liverpool is, it's in one of the most, I guess, impoverished parts of the UK in some respects. So you've got this amazing £350 million hospital in a real area of need. Just if you could just talk to us a little bit about kind of how that, working in that kind of environment, and I guess that gives you a real sense of purpose, I'm assuming.
Yeah, you're right. You know, you drive up to Alderhay and you will have seen it yourself. It is impressive. You know, you can see it from really far away. It looks modern, it looks fresh, it looks new. And as you're looking at Alderhay, I'm struck by this every time I drive to work. As I drive to Alderhay, I drive through one of the most deprived postcodes in the country. And Liverpool's a funny city like that. I'm not from Liverpool. I grew up in the northeast, you know, in another quite impoverished town in Middlesbrough. You know, this isn't lost on me, that the juxtaposition of real deprivation with lots of money in the UK is a very difficult one for me to grasp. And, you know, my family's from India, and you see the same thing there. Some of the richest people in the world live in India, but, you know, also some of the poorest outside their houses. This whole thing is insane. You know, you drive through, or when you're in London, you see pictures of Canary Wharf, and then in front of it, real inner city deprivation. In Liverpool, you know, Anfield, the football ground, one of the largest sporting institutions in the world. And, you know, to be fair to Liverpool, the football club, they do a lot of community work and things. But just beyond that is, again, one of the most deprived council wards in the country. When people say, well, in the UK, the fifth, sixth largest economy in the world, how on earth have we got child poverty? And it basically comes down to the fact that the wealth distribution is so unequal that, you know, a few people hold a lot of the money, you know, a relatively few small amount of people hold a lot of the money. And that's not lost on me at all. And it's not lost on me working in Alderhay. And the impact of coming to hospital, for example, financially on some of these families is really intense. You know, just coming to clinic, we did some work with families coming to my respiratory clinics, and on average, they pay about £30-35 by the time you take into account parking, treats, you know, going to get a sandwich, childcare, lost earnings, travel. You know, this all adds up. And again, it's another reason why we have to strive to make this worthwhile. You know, if people are taking the effort and the expense to come to see us, we need to make it worthwhile. And yeah, that you're exactly right, David. The you know, the dichotomy that you see between money and not money is stark, and in other parts of life is kind of grotesque as well, I'd say. But that's just my view on things.
And well, and it starts to beg the question of what can we do about it? And I have a feeling we're on the edge of a what could be a long emotive political conversation. But unless you're going forward to be the next prime minister, then outside of politics, what's your vision of how you can collaborate to address the challenges?
What an excellent question. It's the age old question. I guess an answer to the first bit of that, without going down a long political rabbit hole, I think the first thing we need to start to think about is the extent of child poverty in the UK. So one in three children pre-COVID were living in poverty, and that number has gone up and we're not quite sure to what yet. There are some really false narratives about poverty. So the age-old thing as well, if they're poor, go out and get a job. Actually, 70% of children living in poverty have at least one parent doing at least one job. You know, we're talking about in-work poverty, and therefore that means it's simply people aren't being paid enough and or the cost of living is too high. And so that becomes the driver for why people haven't got enough money to, in essence, bring their children up as healthy as they would like. And the other false narrative that goes with it is that, you know, these parents are feckless and stupid and bad at budgeting and make bad decisions. They're none of those things. I have the privilege of seeing families in my clinic, some of whom have very difficult circumstances, you know, a lot of whom, for example, might be single mums on benefits and whatnot. And, you know, they're the most resilient, resourceful, caring, fantastic mothers. They're a brilliant group of people. They really are. And it's not that they make bad choices they make for their children. They make the best choices they can. And that, you know, that really gets to me, that they, if they were given the same opportunity as those of us who are fortunate, then their kids would be in a different situation. So in answer to the first part of your question, I've moved away from thinking that child poverty is just one of those things or a product of the economy or just a natural fact of life. It's not natural. It's unnatural. It's a man-made phenomenon. And in essence, without going down that political rabbit hole, child poverty is a political choice because you choose to prioritize a fast train that would get you to London 15 minutes faster over making sure that children in that area have the best opportunities. What we can do about it, I think, as a society, the top of the list by a mile, is that we need to destigmatize poverty. You know, like with so many things in our lives, we struggle to talk about it. And, you know, I'm from a comfortable background. My parents were both pediatricians. I had and have a nice, comfortable life. I don't have the same financial worries that other people have. But that shouldn't stop me from being able to talk about this. And it's important that we talk about it. And when we destigmatize poverty, we start to get to the root of what the problems really are when we think about policies. So, you know, it's been said that stigma is the machinery of inequality, and I totally buy into that. You know, if we didn't have stigma, then we wouldn't be thinking about these parents as being at fault for their children's problems. And once we move past that, that's when we start to say, well, structurally, what's wrong here? You know, if these parents aren't at fault, then something is at fault. What's wrong in the system? But if as a country we can't get past the first step of that, and we, you know, as politicians or the media, you know, whoever it might be, start to vilify or demonize the working classes, then it becomes difficult to move beyond that. So that's my kind of political take on this, is that child poverty can be ended if politicians want it to end. What we need to do about it in the health service, I think there's two aspects to it. One is that activists don't need us to be activists. I get, you know, as other doctors get, you know, we're well compensated for our time and effort, and the taxpayer pays for us to be in our job, not because we're activists, but because we're experts. I've been taught how to be a respiratory paediatrician by amazing people at great expense to the taxpayer. And what they need me to be able to do is to translate poverty to my clinic? What happens in my clinic that we can start to trace back to poverty? And again, you know, as a health service, as hospitals and, you know, clinical teams, we need to start moving away from the idea that, you know, talking about poverty is something that might upset politicians or might be regarded as a bit, you know, we actually need to start talking about it as something that impacts on our families. And the second thing that we need to do is to try and tailor our services such that we can mitigate against the effects of poverty better when we see it in the clinic. So, you know, we need to develop services and use data better and innovate in such a way that, you know, we don't have to wait every 10 years to read another report about how things haven't got better. We need to be addressing them as we come across them. And there's various ways that we can do that. But I think those are the key things. Destigmatize poverty, use our expertise in healthcare to talk about why the problems that are happening in people's homes lead to problems with illness and death in children, and think about how we set up our services better to deal with that.
And the last point you made as well, you talked about how you would tailor the services and how you could use data better. And you said something at the very beginning of our conversation to do with the social determinants of health. And either you said or I thought about predictive factors. Mm-hmm. So I was mulling over, is there something in that? And David and I, as you know, both come from technology backgrounds. Yeah. So a lot of what we're thinking about, I understand innovation isn't just about technology, but about doing things differently. Yeah. But is there something in there and some promise for the future that revolves around, can you spot problems before problems actually happen? So from very, very yeah. early stage of life, can you see factors in a child's profile that present an opportunity for early intervention?
Yeah.
Means something better could happen than if you didn't get involved?
So you have just hit the nail on the head with a project that we're doing in Liverpool at the moment. So again, and this is a paradigm shift in how we need to think about people that come to our clinics and use our services, how we need to think about patients. So by the time I'm seeing a child who's 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, who's wheezy and coughing and having infections, sometimes they will have an underlying diagnosis, an immunodeficiency, cystic fibrosis, you know, something that they've been born with that is causing a problem. But that's a minute number of children compared to what we're actually seeing. The rest of it is just living circumstances. Now, when we see those children, by the time they're having problems, the damage is being done. It's already been done. You know, this stuff happens even before babies are conceived. If you look in this at antenatal outcomes in the States in terms of mortality of infants, stillbirths, preterm births, low birth weights, you know, the things that set your sort of stall for the rest of your life. When we look at, for example, Black women and white women, Black women lose their babies more. They have more preterm babies. And the prevailing hypothesis on this at the moment is that of weathering. In other words, by the time these women have become pregnant, their reproductive systems are less adept at carrying a baby through to full term. We know from work in Southampton and other parts of the UK that antenatal stress is a really important determinant of development of childhood asthma, because the mum's hormones go in a different direction in terms of steroids and inflammation and things like this. And then they lead the child to have less good lungs. All of these things happen early. So what we're looking at in Liverpool is, as data and technology people, I hope you like this. I think it's really exciting. We're going to try and go back really early in that journey. So we're using currently routinely collected data that we already have to basically use deep learning to identify from the children that we see or have seen over the last however many years that we've got data on, what can we trace back? Can we develop a model such that at the 12-week antenatal scan, when parents, or 12-week antenatal clinic appointment, that we can say to mums, right, you know, it seems like your as yet unborn baby is more likely than other children to be admitted to Alder Hey with respiratory problems in the first 5 years of life, and then say, right, well, these are the things that we might be able to modify. So if you were able to stop smoking, these are the things that your child would benefit, and the risk would come down by this much. If you were to breastfeed your child, for example, if you can, then the risk might come down by this. If you live in poor housing, then this increases the risk by this much, and therefore we're gonna sort this out for you. If you are struggling to eat during your pregnancy, it's really important, and this is how we can try. And so if we can move away from these big posters that say breastfeed your child or you're a bad mum, you know, which has been a lot of the driver for the health promotion, if we move away from that to saying, right, forget that, this is your baby, what can we do with you and your life for your baby, I think that might be an appropriate way of moving forward. There are ethical issues with prediction. So in the States, again, there was some work that identified a quite accurate model for children who might be subject to neglect or child protection issues. And the difficulty is, what do you do with that? Because that's, you know, going up to someone saying, well, you're more likely than other people to cause harm to your baby. You know, that becomes a very different and difficult conversation. So this probably isn't for everything. But I think for things like the big killers, respiratory disease, cardiac disease, infections, going back early in time and giving people advice to set their baby off on the right path, on, you know, on the best path, will be a really important thing. And we're trying a similar thing. Hopefully we're trying to get some funding to do that this winter with bronchiolitis. Every year a manager in the hospital comes to me in October and November and says, Ian, what can we do about bronchiolitis? And it's flooding the wards and we're cancelling operations. And every year I say the same thing, which is build a time machine, go back to last year and listen to what I said, which was stop women smoking, help women, empower women to breastfeed, empower women to make informed health choices that will, you know, that aren't things that are passed down through their mates or, you know, social media or whatever they stumble upon, but really evidence-based evidence for their baby. I think it's a nice model, and, you know, I hope it works, but that's what we're starting to do at the moment.
I mean, it's, of course, it's exciting, but the thing that strikes me as you're describing it is that, so there's kind of a big data project behind it and some very advanced technology, but what pops out at the other end is something that is personal and actionable. So, you know, like, why I understand why I don't smoke, by the way, but I understand why I should not smoke, but not looking, it's easy. We can often, maybe especially as mums, but certainly as, you know, you can often compromise your own well-being in favour of everyone else's. But if you're targeting at the impact on my child, then that does motivate me to look after myself better and have better nutrition. And even, I don't know, I even started thinking as you were describing it, the vaccination program that we have in this country, and whether or not you buy into the benefits that that's going to bring your child. Yeah. If you were directed to that from the very earliest time, then it could just influence your thinking in a non-stigmatized manner. Just is a support for you.
But it comes back to a theme that we see time and time again, and you've brought it up, which is empowerment. Yeah. So we talk, you know, that a lot of the people that we are fortunate to have on this podcast talk about, and whatever which way we come around, we talk about and come back to the empowerment of the child, but also the empowerment of the parent. And again, we're coming back to that topic of not the you shall do this because you've been told to do it, but you are we are empowering you to give you the right give you information that will allow you to make the decisions that you can do.
Yeah.
And you've given me or given us the license to talk about this from a political perspective, but it's also one of the kind of $64 million question that comes back to me. And I know a lot of, you know, our mutual contacts and acquaintances and doctors are looking at, but thinking about how we can actually get some figures around preventative measures of care that we can then put to the government to say, did you know, if you are able to help us to stop the you know, bronchiolitis that's going to happen inevitably in the winter of 2021. That would have saved us X moving forward. So we can, you know, start to model these things with the data that fortunately is starting to be recorded now, and you can start to look into the future and say, well, you want to save, you know, taxpayer money, you want to get a healthier population, you want to do all these elements. Well, start to look at these figures, start to look at this data, and start to think further than the five-year term that you are given, which is, I think, a fundamental problem that we have. No government is looking further than, you know, the term of their the term that they've been given by the electorate.
You're exactly right when you talk about that short-termism. And one of the things that I've been heavily involved with this year is food poverty and food insecurity. Now, we as paediatricians think this is it's a no-brainer. You know, this is just a no-brainer. You've got to make sure that children are fed a healthy diet. Now, when you look at why that argument doesn't land, it may be that we're just not pitching it right. And, you know, for us, when we think about food poverty, in fact, when we see children in our clinics, we're not really worried about them now. They're all right now. They might cough a bit. They're all right now. And that, you know, the impact of their symptoms is important and it gets in the way. But we're equally worried about them when they're 35, 45, 55 years of age. So if you look at cystic fibrosis, we published an editorial on this in the Lancet Respiratory Medicine. We looked at in essence, to cut a long story short, if you in cystic fibrosis, you know, the commonest life limiting condition in childhood, in the developed countries, if you look at cystic fibrosis and what really determines your health, these children, you know, it's an unrecognizable condition now to what it used to be, but small impacts on lung function in your infancy, you know, very small measurements or small improvements based on, you know, quite a lot of hard work, nebulizers, physiotherapy, this, that, and the other. That small increase, negligible seemingly increase in lung function, reduces your risk of dying in your 20s by 50%. What we're talking about here is investment in children. And we are saying, you won't see the benefits now necessarily. You might do if we made sure. So what me and others have been led very much by an MP called Ian Byrne from Liverpool, have been really pushing for the right to food, the human right to food, to be enshrined in the UK law. In other words, whoever's at the top, whatever government it is, has accountability and responsibility for making sure that there are no structural reasons why people are hungry, and for me, obviously, children are hungry. And the things that we were pushing for were things like universal free school meals, breakfast and lunch, not means tested throughout the year. Take away any stigma that goes away with needing these free school meals. Accept that parents, or believe and trust that parents, will use that money and reinvest it in their own children, because that's what parents do. And then you start to see a population of children growing who are healthier and living their best life. And what we struggled to get across to people is, yes, okay, there is something about now, you know, if children are well fed, then they'll do better at school and, you know, things like that, and they'll feel better, they'll be less hungry. What we're really talking about is them in 20, 30, 40 years' time and what they can provide for their children. Investment in children is something that is bottom of the pile. Without going down another rabbit hole, that's for two reasons. Firstly, it's because they don't pay taxes, and secondly, it's because they don't vote. And so you're right, that short-termism hits children harder than anyone else. And, you know, I mentioned to you both that recently I've been involved with a community in the Midlands who live next to a landfill site. And again, this whole idea of you are investing in the future of these children, it's sometimes just really difficult to land, you know. And one of the key things that we find is that there's not an urgency to do things about children, even though time is of the essence to them. So a policy that might take 3, 4, 5 years for us to see the benefit as grown-ups is one thing. That, you know, that just happens. You just accept that things take time. That is their entire preschool time gone. You know, that's the entire time that their lungs are developing, gone. While we muck about talking about, well, we'll give a landfill site owners another year, that's 20% of a five-year-old's life. You know, that's 20% of his lung growth potential impaired because we are so slow to act on this. When adults were deemed to be at risk or felt to be at risk at the beginning of COVID, we rightly built hospitals in 2 weeks. We said we need to act because adults are at risk of this disease. We knew at that point children weren't at risk. When adults are at risk, we act fast. When kids are at risk, we're having the same conversations now that I had at medical school 25 years ago. You know, there is no urgency to do anything. Kids are bottom of the pile. And you're exactly right when you say that the short-termism is the problem here. The short-termism and the stigma that goes with living in poverty, being on benefits, being a single mum, being a mum, let alone a single mum. In fact, being a mum of any social background. You know, we do not revere mothers in this country. And when we think about modelling, if you look at countries that do things better than we do, I don't know if any of your listeners are in Scandinavia, but they have far lower rates of death from infection in infants. They have far lower rates of hospital admissions for asthma. And when you trace it back, it basically comes down to how you look after your pregnant mums and how you give rights to mums and dads who've just had babies. They look at our paternity rights and go, you know, our paternity leave sort of entitlement rights and go, what the hell are you doing? Who's looking after your baby if you're at work in 2 weeks? And, you know, my colleagues in public health go around around Europe and the world, and public health specialists from other countries say to them, why do you hate children in the UK? And you can see what they're getting at. You can see that what they're getting at is our policies are not focused on children. COVID wasn't focused on children. You know, like we said before, if you're in a society where pubs are open before schools are open, something is wrong. And, you know, we need to learn from this last year, and we need to take a long, hard look at how, even though children weren't the face of the COVID pandemic, they've been just as deeply affected and possibly, you know, generationally for a long, long time.
I think you're putting in a great case for a Secretary of State for Children or Children's Minister, which we'd vote for you, Ian.
I would vote for both of you.
You've mentioned Scandinavia and, you know, what they're doing, but we also have discussed previously just the advantages of having a paediatric specialist as a first port of call or as a primary health, primary care facilitator. Talk to us a little bit about your thoughts on that, please.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I've got a lot of respect and a lot of time for our primary care colleagues. They get bashed, you know, from every corner of the media, and they get bashed from hospital specialists. And, you know, I really feel for them, and they do a great job. But when we think about what general practice offers, and I'm not just talking about general practice, I'm talking about primary care, but also secondary care, tertiary care, quaternary level care, the services aren't as good as they need to be for children. So we need to make sure that we're providing excellent, excellent care. And, you know, as we said before your podcast, one of the reasons that your podcast is so important is because the key to everything is education and specialists. And we're sometimes so caught up in the way that we do things and how it can't possibly change that we forget to look at things through the lens of a parent. So quite often when I have tried to sort of instigate changes in primary care around asthma, I get quite snotty things saying, well, you know, how would you like it if you were a GP working single-handedly and some fella from Alderhay was saying you should do things better? And I'm like, well, that's not really the question. How would you like it if you were a mum that spent that day's benefits getting a bus to go and see someone who's not been trained in paediatric asthma? You know, we've got to get that balance right. We rely on general practice so much. And I know in Scandinavia and certainly in the States as well, you know, family medicine has got an element of it, of family paediatrics or, you know, general primary care paediatrics. And that's certainly something I'd love to see happening here. And I think it I think it will happen, and I think it is happening. So, for example, we are doing lots of work at the moment to try and improve our asthma outcomes in the UK. Asthma is my main condition that I manage. It's something that's really, you know, I don't have asthma. I've never wheezed in my life, but I really feel for these kids. And there's over 1 million children with asthma in the UK. We need to do better for them. And, you know, we need to look better at what we're doing in hospital medicine, but we also need to think about that interface between primary and secondary care and how we can make that, you know, management of asthma better in there. And again, a lot of that comes down to data. There's a large national audit that's happening at the moment. I'm currently leading the paediatric element of that, and there's a primary care element of that too. And there are things that we need to be doing better. And again, David, you mentioned empowerment before. It comes back to empowerment. You know, it's about enabling families to self-manage. That's about education. It's about making sure people know how to use their inhalers, when to use their inhalers, and what to do when they're having an asthma attack. It's about getting the very basics of care right. And that's something that, you know, even in our lovely shiny hospital in Alderhay, we sometimes don't always get that right. And we need to get that right across the board, even beyond healthcare. You know, we tried this thing once and it worked pretty well, and I think it still happens, but PE teachers in Liverpool can refer directly to my clinic, because if anybody knows who's got asthma, it's not me, it's PE teachers. If anybody knows who's got food allergies, it's not our allergists, it's the dinner ladies. You know, we need to be thinking about, I see, you know, even the kids that I see really frequently, I see them over the course of a year. Even if I see them every couple of months, I've seen them for like a couple of hours. You know, we need to link with the way they live. We need to tap into the rhythms of their life and see what's really happening, you know, around them. And primary care, I think, does play a really good role in keeping children well, but it could be better. And once it's perfect, once we take out any doubt about how well or otherwise we're managing children, then we can go in hard to number 10 and say, we are doing the best we can, you aren't doing the best you can. And it's a really important element of this that we sometimes forget. So yeah, that idea of paediatricians in primary care, I think, is an excellent one.
And I've got a curious question about your vision for asthma and where you can go with it. And the reason and where it's come from is we spoke to an incredible woman in Australia she had a program around childhood cancer and it is about getting to the
zero childhood
eliminating cancer in children.
Yeah.
And she feels that's achievable. And we've talked to other people, and it was to do with pain, and that pain should be possible. So pain is something that can be, or the idea would be that it can be eliminated, and we don't just accept pain as part of an experience, but so we'll aim for zero pain.
In Miami Children's Hospital, it's actually there as a medical error. It's deemed as a medical error in their charter.
Wow. So I'm curious about for asthma and the work that you and colleagues are doing in that area. Is it possible that you can get to through management that it can be a completely manageable condition? Because I understand that when it's not managed, it can be extremely dangerous as well.
It's exactly what we should aim for. And it's exactly what we should aim for. We should be aiming for all, you know, if you go to any children's hospital in the world in some kind of value or charter, they say, oh, we want the best for all children. Do we really act like that? Do we want the best for all children? Because if we did, we would be pushing much harder for things to be better. So, yeah, that's the goal. I love the idea that in Australia they're saying, you know, cancer in children is not acceptable. I get that. And I get that even if you try and sort of get rid of it completely, there will be some children with cancer. But why are we aiming for anything less? Why are we aiming for a reduction in asthma attacks? Why aren't we saying, look, if you've got asthma, we need to make really sure that we do everything we can to make sure that you don't have asthma attacks? Because they're scary, they're damaging to your lungs, they're a huge imposition on your life. And even from the, you know, even if you aren't interested in children, you know, people who aren't interested in children are usually interested in money. And the you know, obviously there's a Venn diagram and there's people interested in both, you know, but the financial and health services argument for stopping asthma attacks is immense. And again, you know, if you look at our clinic, you know, we run a regional asthma clinic. It's huge. We've got a large cohort. 90% of them are from the most deprived decile of deprivation. So in some ways, asthma is a fact of life. You know, there are diseases, there are illnesses. It is what it is. But in other ways, the impact of those illnesses is what we should be, you know, we should be looking at preventing things, absolutely. And we should not accept that people have problems. We've got to move off this thing that we're doing the best we can, given the resources that we can. If we're doing the best we can and the resources are an issue, then you're not being given enough. As a, you know, one of the hills I will absolutely die on, and I will say this till the day I die, is that it is completely wrong to charge people to park at a hospital. And it comes back to the same thing, that if you're having to charge people to come to your hospital to pay for your hospital, your government is not giving your hospital enough money. You know, if we're really not doing well enough because we're constrained, we need to say that. We need to say, look, children are suffering because we've not got enough money as a health service. So that preventative side of it comes as in important here as well, that when we look at why children, and I don't want to get too scientific here because I understand that you've got a wide-ranging audience, but the gist of it is that we think of poverty as having effects on just lifestyle and, you know, well, okay, these kids have asthma because of smoke and this, that, and the other. And that's true. You know, there are things that you're exposed to in poverty that can trigger your asthma. But the other thing alongside that that people don't always realize is that when we, you know, there's this common saying, poverty gets under your skin. It doesn't just get under your skin. Poverty gets into your DNA. So up to about 10% of your DNA is determined by where you live and by the circumstances in which you live. So when we talk about poverty getting under your skin, what we really mean is that it gets into the very thread of chemicals, the, you know, the molecules that make up who you are, your DNA, you, your thing, your DNA. Poverty affects the way that your DNA works. And the way that it affects it in asthma is to increase the levels of inflammation or the immune system abnormality that happens in asthma and makes your airways smaller. So when we see the poorest children having asthma attacks, yes, some of it might be the chaotic lives that they live, some of it might be the stuff that they're exposed to, but some of it will be that their body has modified itself because they are poor and is driving their asthma. So, you know, we need a whole multifaceted approach to this, and we need to take what you've just said, Hannah, as being the standard that we aim for, you know, that in real terms, we need to stop moving away from this being just sentences and platitudes that managers and clinicians and people say, to actually being something that we strive for. And I will check out that charter in Miami, because that is what we should be aiming for. We should be, you know, we have never events in children in theatre, for example, you know, operating on the wrong leg or, you know, and in medicine, we don't have that. We need to have that. We need to have that. If a child is having an asthma attack, that's the canary in the mine. That's something telling us that something is going wrong in this child's body. And at various levels, we need to address that. One is on the ward and making sure that people go home with education and information that can empower them to self-manage. And we need to work that right the way through to knocking on the Prime Minister's door to say children are being held back because of poverty or whatever it might be, you know, family care, family medicine, paediatricians, or whatever it might be. We need to be aiming for, you know, a zero tolerance on preventable problems, and asthma attacks are a preventable problem in many cases. You know, many, many cases, cancer is a preventable problem. Pain is a preventable problem. Breathlessness is the new pain in my mind. You know, we accept that people are breathless. And actually, if you're not getting breathless, I know you guys have run triathlons. You're not going to get me running a triathlon. You don't want me to run a triathlon. I'll be there for days. But, you know, if you're not getting breathless every day, something's not right. You should be getting breathless. But that point where it becomes, you know, what we call dyspnea or uncomfortable or distressing, that point is something we can do about. You know, pain is a common thing. Get pain if you stub your toe. But we need to stop thinking about pain in people with cancer or surgical problems as being anything like the natural things that we accept. And yet we, you know, we accept that children get breathless, and then we accept that they don't do PE, and then we accept this and that and the other, and then we shout at them and their parents when they are obese. You know, we've got to uphold our end of the bargain, which is to aim for the best standards possible. I think you've said something there that we in the healthcare profession need to be, you know, we need to take that seriously, and we need to take a long, hard look at what it is that we're really trying to do.
Ian, we could literally talk to you for hours. I think this has been such, as we said at the beginning, this is such an important conversation, and we've, albeit the nature of the topic that we're talking about is not something that we enjoy, but we've really loved talking to you. There's one last question that we always ask everybody that's on our podcast. But before that, I feel I have to mention something that's been kind of on the tip of my tongue since we've been talking, which is that coming back to the whole transport element and the parking element that you were talking about. And hopefully someone will listen to this and think that they might be able to replicate this model. But at the Boston Children's Hospital in the US, actually, they came up with a concept of kind of an Uber for patients, whereby patients were actually being put into a car and brought to the hospital to alleviate that element of a, I don't know if they're having to pay for it in Boston, but, you know, paying for the parking or not getting there. When Ian Hennessy and I were working together on looking at some of the costs that were associated with people missing appointments, this was 5-6 years ago, it's about £180 per appointment missed. Now, I'm assuming inflation has meant that that's gone up. So let's assume that it's £200 per appointment missed, not even thinking about the cost that it's going to cost someone that is in a state of poverty to try and get there. So, you know, hopefully someone might actually think about that, bring that into the UK. But it's could be such an important solution. Anyway, it's been on my mind. We've been kind of flitting around it. But the final question that we'll ask everyone on the podcast is, if you had a magic wand in to change anything within paediatric healthcare, what would that be?
It would be all... what an amazing question. For me right now, and this will come as no surprise to people who've listened through this episode of the podcast, but for me, the big changer would come if we decided, which we can do, to end children being in poverty in the UK and globally, not just the UK. If we ended child poverty tomorrow, the health landscape forever would look completely different. And that's what my magic wand would be. It's not actually a really good answer to your question, because it's not a magic wand. It's in our hands. We don't need magic to do this. We just need somebody to prioritize children over other stuff that we prioritize, and this would be a no-brainer. And similarly, globally, you know, you and I all know that the best economy that we can hope for is a globally thriving economy, particularly now that, you know, we're making deals with all kinds of countries that I've not even heard of before. And, you know, we need a really thriving economy. And the only way that you do that is by having a thriving population that's well-educated and healthy. And so, you know, addressing this globally is something within the hands of, you know, obviously there are statistics that the 100 richest people in the world could end child poverty 4 times over, with, you know, hardly a scratch on their income. You know, we can do this. It's not a magic wand. It's not a magic wand. What would I do with my magic wand? If it was actually a magic wand, I think I would bring in the voice of parents and families more into what we do. You have higher standards than we do as a health service. We get constrained by what we think we can do. You're not constrained because you walk into this and go, well, this is what my child deserves. And we need to start thinking like this. We need to start thinking, this is what your child deserves, not this is what we can do. So that would be, alongside the poverty, the biggest thing that I would change.
Ian, thank you. Thank you so, so much for joining us tonight. It's it's just been a phenomenal conversation, and we really hope that it will inspire others to want to kind of get on the crusade with us. And I was told when we were introduced that you would be a wonderful person to talk to, but you know just surpassed any expectations. So thank you so much.
Thank you for the invite. It's been a real pleasure meeting both of you, and you know, it's been a real pleasure looking at what you do with your charity and things that you're achieving. It's inspirationally good, and I hope that I hope that as many people as can, you know, as possible can support it. It really is, and I'm very grateful and very honoured.
Thank you for joining us on the Not Many Adults podcast, pioneers for children's health and well-being. We really hope that you enjoyed that episode. You can find episodes of all of the first three seasons of the podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you, like us, are dedicated to making a difference in children's health, then we hope you'll be inspired by some of the amazing people and stories that we've had the privilege to talk to and to share. We really hope that you'll join us again. And if anybody knows of anyone that you think that we should be talking to on the podcast, then please do get in touch. Thank you so much for listening.